Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker took home Best Picture Sunday night at the Oscars. It put a bright spotlight on the high-risk world of the U.S. military's anti-IED units. But Hollywood is one thing. The reality on the ground is like this. Just last month in Afghanistan alone, troops encountered 721 IEDs. They cleared more than 400, but 28 coalition forces were killed by the hidden bombs. 176 were wounded. Today, we'll talk with the real-life soldiers who have taken the most dangerous front in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The battlefront beneath, it's a high and low-tech front, a psychological front. This hour on Point, we're going beyond the Hurt Locker to the real battle with IEDs. Here's a scene from the movie. Three-man explosive ordnance disposal team in Iraq examines an IED with a remote-controlled robot and talks about how to set the bomb off without harming anyone.
Yeah. Oh, look at that.
Nice 155, huh?
Yeah.
Hey, Eldridge, looks like we're going to need a charge.
Oh, I got that. Figured 4 blocks. That'll give us about 20 pounds of bang total.
That blast is going to roll straight out there. The shell will probably kick out there. Most of the shrapnel is going to shoot straight up in a beautiful umbrella pattern.
Yeah.
We're going to get some smaller pieces and shell fragments this way, but we'll be okay if we're behind the Humvee. You bring the bot back, we'll load it up.
No problem.
No problem, unless you're there. You can join the conversation this hour. What's your question about the real work of those who take on the buried bombs? Is it your worst nightmare? Military families, what about the human cost of this front? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A little later in this hour, we'll hear from one of the top IED specialists currently serving in the U.S. military, a man who's been through 44 IED attacks and many, many defusings. But joining us first from Fredericksburg, Virginia, is Kevin Lutz, retired Army colonel, who was the top officer overseeing the military's EOD, Explosive Ordnance Devices, work in Iraq from 06 to 09. He led the 52nd Explosive Ordnance Device Group. The Hurt Locker depicts members of that group. He led Task Force Troy, fighting IEDs at the height of the Iraq War, served 3 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, been awarded 2 Bronze Stars. He's now Executive VP at AT Solutions, a company focusing on global counterterrorism. Colonel Lutz, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here, sir.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Well, and very happy to have you. Also from Fredericksburg, Jonathan Hunter, retired Army captain who served as an explosive ordnance device officer in Afghanistan, primarily in the Khost and Kandahar areas. He served with Kevin Lutz in Afghanistan, now works for Allen Vanguard, the company that makes the bomb suits featured in The Hurt Locker. He works on anti-IED systems and briefs Congress on the latest technology. Captain Hunter, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I want to get a read, first of all, from the two of you on the movie itself. We're going to go right on deep to the reality, but give us a take, Colonel Lutz, first to you, on the movie. Is this a fair depiction of the diffusing of these explosives in the Iraq front, let's say?
Well, it's certainly the scenarios that were depicted there are reality. You saw everything plus, and it's good that, you know, what Catherine Bigelow and Mark Bowl brought out, that, you know, what the EOD forces are doing today. But there was certainly some artistic liberties taken by Hollywood and how the EOD operator goes down and performs his mission. I would tell you, I almost came across as being reckless and cavalier, which is not how EOD operators perform their job. They're very proficient, well-led, and use everything possible to provide the safest opportunity for them to execute the mission without causing a detonation or any collateral damage. So there's a mix of realism as well as fiction in the movie.
Captain Hunter, Jonathan Hunter, what was your take on the movie, The Hurt Locker?
They put a year deployment in a two-hour movie, so yeah. I'll just leave it at that. It's a great movie, and it's nice to finally have the EOD field recognized for the hard work that they do. So.
You work with the company that makes the bomb suits. Even if people haven't seen the movie, they probably saw that clip at the Academy Award ceremonies where we see this big, kind of bigger than a space suit with the helmet and all the rest. There's one moment where I guess the bomb is so big and dangerous that the actor takes off his bomb suit and says, what the heck, if I'm going to die, I might as well die comfortable. Realistic or unrealistic?
It depends on the situation, but I would say most likely they would not take off their bomb suit. The hazards that exist more beyond just the initial bomb and device that they're facing. There are secondary and tertiary devices that they could be surrounded by.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, it would be unadvised to take off their bomb suit.
But it's 100 and who knows what degrees there. Have you ever seen a situation where the bomb was so big that, in fact, there was no surviving if it didn't work, and so off it came?
I personally have not, so I'll just leave it at that.
Colonel, what about the moment that this is depicting? I mean, the scriptwriter was out in, I think, 04, looking at this work in Iraq. Is that a different world from the world we're in with IEDs now, or still kind of the way it goes?
Well, there's no doubt we've evolved in how we handle IEDs and how well and prepared both equipment and tactics, techniques, and procedures that the EOD forces are currently employing. In 2004, we were certainly trained for it, but it was something that we weren't expecting. In the height between 2006, 2007, we were seeing 3,000 IEDs a month that was reported. So I think you've got to look at, you know, what they were doing at that time. They were doing with the best that they had, the understanding of the capability, but we have far advanced beyond that as we totally or fully exploit the IED from every aspect to understand its capability as well as how the enemy employs it, and then we take that and then that's fed back into our training program as well as the equipment that they currently have that allow them to conduct the operations even safer in today's world, both in today's time, both mm-hmm. in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Could you tell us, Kevin Lutz, about, I don't know, some of the more compelling examples of IEDs you come up against? You and Jonathan Hunter and many others have seen a lot by now. You must have a kind of, maybe trophy case is the wrong word, but you must have memories of some of the most difficult or challenging devices you came up against. Can you give us an example or two?
Well, I can give you a couple of examples, and I think it can relate to what you were talking about. Is there a bomb that's too big that you take the bomb suit off? Back in 2008, and this is not just an isolated case. I mean, this happened all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a 5,000 pound bomb, vehicle-borne IED in Mosul, where the EOD operator had to go down there, took the robot, and did everything he could to neutralize the IED itself to prevent it from going off,
mm-hmm.
Disarmed it, was down there in a bomb suit, and then was able to get it to the point that they could actually tow it outside the city so that when it was detonated, it didn't cause mass collateral damage.
5,000 pounds, that's a big chunk of explosives.
It was, and that was not uncommon. I mean, we saw IEDs that were 15 and 20,000 pounds that they would load up in dump trucks, and then they would drive those. This one we happened to find, it was inside the city, and they were able to render safe it and then move it outside the city to dispose of it. A couple of other IEDs that were real significant are your explosively formed penetrators that the Iraqis used, the Sunnis and Shia against us, that virtually could penetrate anything that we had at the time.
Armor-piercing, whatever plate you had, there was the allegation these might have been coming in from Iran.
Yeah, it's more than an allegation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
there's no doubt that this thing moved from the Baikal Valley through Israel into Iraq, through probably Syria and Iran.
Maybe with Iranian support. And what about those?
Well, those them themselves. I mean, one, the you know, there's two parts of it. You've got the actual IED itself, and then you've got the projectile. This was more of a plate, and then you had the initiation system. And the initiation systems are very tricky. They'd use RF technology, and then they would add, which would arm it, and then they would use
RF as in radio frequency.
Radio frequency. Mm-hmm. Yep. I'm mm-hmm. sorry. Mm-hmm. Radio frequency. So anything that emitted a signal could be used, cell phones, long-range cordless telephones,
mm-hmm.
personal mobile radios, and then they would initiate it through different switches. Most common one was a passive infrared sensor commonly used on your garage doors. So as you walked up, it would sense heat and motion. So they did that for purposes to defeat our capabilities, which I won't go into. Mm-hmm. Very sophisticated, but until you were able to dearm those, you never knew how they were doing it, what technology they were using, or how they were actually employing the devices.
And Captain Hunter, the methods used always evolving, and not entirely the same in Afghanistan as in Iraq.
Absolutely, the terrain is different, the climate is different, the people are different. Right, how you socialize with an Iraqi is completely different than how you socialize with an Afghanistani.
And I think the explosives were different. A lot of old military ordnance in Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of ammonium nitrate fertilizer turned into explosive.
Correct. You'll see a lot of ampho and a lot of urea nitrate in Afghanistan. But one of the interesting things that you'll find in Afghanistan is that there's just piles and piles of ordnance, as in on the outside in Iraq as well, of just ordnance that's been left there from the Soviet Union days.
That can be bundled into IEDs, into underground threats.
Correct. In fact, Colonel Lutz and I had the experience of detonating over 422 bombs together on one massive explosion.
Wow.
That we conducted in Afghanistan.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real war with the IED, the improvised explosive device, given the movie treatment in the now Oscar-winning film The Hurt Locker. Here's director of that film, Kathryn Bigelow, in her acceptance speech for Best Director Sunday night, acknowledging U.S. troops.
I'd just like to dedicate this to the women and men in the military who risk their lives on a daily basis in Iraq and Afghanistan and around the world, and may they come home safe. Thank you.
And here's a scene from the top of the movie. Bomb disposal team attempts to disarm an IED. Things go awry when they see a man in the distance with a cell phone about to make a call.
Burn him, Eldridge! Burn him!
Put down the cell phone!
Eldridge, burn him! Get out of the way!
Drop your phone!
Take him, put it down! Go get it! Burn him, Eldridge!
I can't get a shot!
And up it goes in the Hurt Locker. We've been joined this hour by Colonel Kevin Lutz at the very top of the U.S. effort to combat IEDs in Iraq, later in Afghanistan. Captain Jonathan Hunter with us as well. His work especially in Afghanistan on IEDs. And we're joined right now from Arlington, Virginia by Command Sergeant Major Todd Burnett. He is one of the top IED specialists currently serving in the U.S. Military, senior enlisted advisor to the Department of Defense's special team, known as JIDO, the Joint Improvised Explosive Device Defeat Organization, has served a lot in Iraq, in Afghanistan, has been through 44 IED attacks, 23 direct hits on his vehicle, recipient of the Purple Heart, many other honors. Command Sergeant Major Todd Burnett, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good morning, sir.
First of all, I just wanted to ask, you haven't talked much publicly about this work. Why are you talking now?
I don't want to highlight a lot of what I did. I'd rather keep it focused on the warfighters that are on the ground each and every day making the sacrifice for our freedom.
But maybe this is a time when Americans are focused on that work because of the movie, and you're speaking up because of that focus?
Well, I will say that the Hurt Locker, if it didn't do anything else, it highlighted some great Americans that are out there at the forefront with the EOD. I had the privilege to serve with Colonel Lutz and a lot of his folks, and I was there at the height of the surge as well. When it wasn't whether you were going to when you were going to get blown up, it was when it was going to happen as we traveled down the roads. So I think they highlighted something that's very important to me, but I think that they also depicted some things that they don't necessarily do, as you probably heard previously from the captain and from Colonel Lutz.
Well, they gave us some of their observations there, but we'd be interested in yours as well. How do you see the difference between what we saw in the film, perhaps, and what you have seen and continue to see on the ground?
Well, it seems to me that they kind of portrayed a guy who's out there like he's in the Wild Wild West when these guys are very very professional in what they do and try to take everything into account. And they do it in a different manner than was portrayed, because they'll typically try to use a robot first, and kind of as a last resort, they'll go down to an IED, and they're always going to be in a bomb suit. So they're going to put risk management into everything they do and not just head right down as sometimes was portrayed in the movie.
Sergeant Major, what about the thing that struck everybody about the movie was the super intensity of this work? I mean, the stakes are so high, the explosives can be so enormous. What about the psychological intensity, the work intensity of just addressing these explosives? Did you relate to that? Did you recognize that?
Oh, absolutely. What I did while I was in my tours in Iraq and Afghanistan is I did route clearance, so I went out and looked for the bombs every day, and I was there as a battalion sergeant major on an iteration, and then came back as a brigade sergeant major who supported the MNCI with the Theater Engineer Brigade. And at the height of the surge, I had 28 patrols that were going out every day and looking for IEDs, and I don't think it gets any more intense than that. Each day they're going down there, and probably the only people that it's more intense for is the people that are going down to either try to disarm them or to clear them, because, as you know, in the beginning we didn't have any authority to dispose of them. So what we did once we found them, we cordoned the area off, and then we'd call for EOD support that would arrive with a QRF, sir.
The QRF is what, Sergeant Major?
Quick Reaction Force.
I see, to go in with their specialty in exactly this work. We're really pleased to have all three of you with us. We have a lot of listeners with observations and questions, and I'd like to begin to go to them. Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Mike, you are on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Mike.
I'm relating directly to the Sergeant Major there. I was part of the surge in 07, and you were wondering what was the scariest type of IED.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in route clearance, it doesn't matter if it's a mortar round or if it's a 155. The route clearance team is usually on foot.
What's a 155, Mike, if I may ask?
It's the size of an artillery round.
I see.
And a lot of times the clearing teams are actually on foot next to the vehicles walking, looking for these things in areas that, especially during the surge, nobody had been there so long, the dirt had actually baked over them. It looked like nobody had ever been there.
So maybe the scariest ones were the ones that had been forgotten about, practically.
Those were the scariest ones. And even the locals had forgotten about them. And I actually had an occasion where 30 vehicles had rolled over the same exact spot. And at the very end of the column, one of my vehicles went to back up, hit a bomb. So those are scary.
Mike, what's it like to go when you're going basically into battle, into a fight, but you've got to watch every step? You know, we think of charging into battle, not, you know, carefully.
It's nerve-wracking. It's nerve-wracking. And it doesn't get any better the more tours you do, because all that happens is when you go for your next tour, now you know what to expect. And it's very,
and it's not fun.
The EOD men, they're the same way. They're on the high alert the whole time. I mean, not the way the movie portrays them crazy like that. But
EOD, explosive ordnance device.
Mm-hmm. It is a constant tension.
That has got to be tough, Mike. I appreciate your call, Colonel Lutz. What about that? Making war when every step could be your last. You know, how do you have the adrenaline surging to go into a fight and yet know every step you take is maybe mortal?
Well, I mean, for all the forces over there, it is a nerve-wracking, as Mike was talking about. You know, for the engineers and the EOD forces, they know what they're up against. It doesn't make it any easier. And EOD, we have a saying, initial success or total failure. So that's why, as Command Sergeant Major Burnett was talking about, is we make sure that everything we do is precise. And what we've done and learned from 2004, and we're not there yet, but, you know, to help Mike and all the other service members that have served or continue to serve and go on multiple tours, is
is to learn from the IED so that and know where they went off, so that we can share that information back to the force, so that it's not just walking into a minefield and you don't know what type of mines are there, but they actually know what type of mines are there and whether or not they're arm infusing, and I'm relating that to a more conventional sense. You know, that's what we're trying to do. That's what GIDL has done, and that's what a Task Force Paladin in Afghanistan does today and a Task Force Troy does in Iraq, and it's just a way of process that if we can understand that fully, then we can provide that intelligence to the forces so that, you know, they're not left there not knowing what to expect. They can anticipate what to expect and then employ proper tactics, techniques, and procedures.
Captain Hunter, what about in the clip we heard just at the top of this segment, you had one soldier talking to another. He saw someone in the distance with a cell phone. You know, he's saying, burn him, burn him. I guess that means shoot him because he's afraid he's about to trigger it. That seemed fairly common in Iraq. Does that same dynamic show up in Afghanistan?
Absolutely. I would point out that I'm not worried about the enemy I can see. I'm more worried about the enemy I cannot see. And you'll find that the sense of situational awareness is extremely high with EOD operators. We're strategic in thought as well as we move. It's not like you can see an enemy who's shooting at you, right? And it does play on your mind. 24/7 when you're out there. So
let's go to Mary in Providence, Rhode Island. Mary, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Hi, officers. I just, first of all, I'm glad you're all safe and sound. And I just want to ask you if you could comment more generally. The thing I found most affecting about the film was that the ending was kind of unexpected in Hollywood terms. You know, usually in Hollywood, you know, something really tragic happens, and the audience gets to feel really tragic, and then there's this sort of, what's the Greek word for it? You know, this purging of emotions.
And I found catharsis that the comes there, yeah.
Catharsis, thank you. So, and the movie didn't end that way. There was no catharsis. It was this sort of endless, or the hint that this was an endless grind. And so that, to me, that was a powerful emotion that was expressed in the film. And then the other one is the quote that I think the officers have all somewhat alluded to in talking about the intensity of the situation. But the quote at the beginning, you know, war is a drug, and this idea of adrenaline being addictive. I'm just wondering if the officers would comment on those two aspects of the film, because I know we focused a lot on the realism of the actual, you know, removal of the IEDs and the professionalism of the forces. And I really respect that, but I also want to dig a little bit deeper into that emotional component, and specifically with those two things, the war is a drug opening, and then the ending, the sort of, you know, the cyclical nature of this situation.
Yeah, Mary, we've got it, and I thank you. Command Sergeant Major, what about it? The movie says war is a drug. It's adrenaline-driven. You said there was too much of a cowboy portrayal. On the other hand, when you're sort of pickled in that adrenaline every day, that must be something to deal with over time. How have you found that emotionally, even in terms of your kind of body chemistry?
Well, I wouldn't say that war is a drug. At this point, I think people have been on multiple deployments, as you heard folks allude to, and we're tied to this. So it's a commitment that you want to see this through, and make sure that it goes right. And there's ways that different people get ready to go out on a patrol. And as you talk, and you heard people talk earlier, the one thing that I did want to highlight about, you know, God bless all them soldiers that are over there every day that are encountering IEDs, but the goodness and the thing that we need to highlight about route clearance and about EOD is we are equipped differently. So what I told my folks as they got ready to go out and look for IEDs on a daily basis was, you know, mission success was you either find it or it blows up you. Now, I don't want it to blow them up, but in the end, we were equipped different, and we still are equipping route clearance patrols in EOD.
You mean to survive it if it blows?
Well, sir,
or you
absolutely
hope?
To survive it.
You've been through 23 of those.
I have, and again, when you're out there, that to me is success. that if it goes off on me, it didn't hit somebody that might be in a lesser protected vehicle. That's what my mission is. My mission is to go out. So as we train people, we want to emphasize to the folks that are going to do that mission. Everybody's got the mission to go out, but that's our sole mission, to go out and find IEDs. So I don't think that it's everybody gets ready for it in a different manner, but we have an expectation, and we train people from early on that that's their mission, and that was my mission, and that's EOD's mission, to go out so they have an understanding.
Colonel Lutz, what about Mary alludes to the endless grind, and it does sound like it must be that. What about the psychological effect of that? I mean, you say it's not the sort of wild man cowboy that does this work, but that some people must react to it that way after a while. You must, just send them around the bend. You have to watch out for that when you're commanding units like these.
Absolutely. What Mary brings out is particularly for the engineers and the EOD forces, and I'll speak to EOD since that's what I did. There's not many of them. It's a low density, high demand capability that exists within all the services. It's not just the Army, and so their tour cycles are probably accelerated or enhanced more than the regular forces. The engineers are very similar, but most of those service members serving today have gone in. To highlight the end of the movie, I think, you're looking at, and I went back and watched the movie three times. First, I was disappointed with the things that came out that really portrayed us in a negative sense.
Negative meaning the wild part, or?
Right. The wild part, the drinking, and we talk about going off post by yourself. That would never happen. Mm-hmm. Sergeant Major talked about when EOD responded, they always had a security element with them.
That's the movies there.
Right, and so that was the artistic liberty taken. Mm-hmm. At the end, though, when you look at it, it comes down to post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. That's part of what Jeremy's going through. The other thing is, for after doing a 7, a 12, and a 15-month deployment, and I'll tell you that 15-month deployment was not easy. The 12s are not easy. Mm-hmm. But you're constantly in a heightened sense of alertness that you got to go out there, as we've talked about, and every day could be the end, either if you're finding those IEDs or then you go in to render safe them. Mm-hmm. And we accept that. EOD, it's totally volunteer. You don't go into EOD, you're not forced into it. Mm-hmm. And so when you come back, there's a huge decompression that you go through. And then every day is it's such a stressful event. Then you come back, and as he's looking at the serial, it's like, what did I choose? I've got all these options. There's not artillery rounds coming in on me. I'm not dealing with IEDs. And some folks, I shouldn't say some folks, a lot of folks deal with that differently. And I think that's what you're seeing is he needed a sense of belonging. And that's what you get. It's not a drug. It's having job satisfaction, particularly in the MOSs, military occupational skills that we're talking about with engineers and EODs, but across the force. And they get into that, and they want to have success, and they want to go out and do the right things that saves lives and limbs, all those that are serving. And then more importantly is, as we do this for the nation, we want this threat to stay abroad. We don't want it to come home. If you can imagine having 3,000 IEDs go off in the U.S.,
Can you imagine that?
No, I can't. I can't imagine what would happen to this country. It'd shut down.
Well, it's hard. It's scary even to think about it. But they have spread beyond Iraq and Afghanistan. They are showing up elsewhere now.
Which makes it important for us to understand them for what we do in theater, and then organizations like JIDO that can learn from those. That there's a byproduct that occurs or a sidebar. All this information comes back to Homeland Defense here. So it's not lost. I mean, not that that's what we do it for, but we do take that intelligence and it comes back and it helps protect the homeland.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the real war with the IED, the improvised explosive device given the movie treatment in the now Oscar-winning film The Hurt Locker. Here's a scene where Sergeant William James, played by Jeremy Renner, shows another soldier a collection of grim souvenirs, pieces from bombs he has disarmed.
What do we have here?
They're, bomb parts, signatures.
Yeah, I see that, but what are they doing under your bed?
Well... Uh-huh. This one. From the UN building. Flaming car. Dead man switch. Boom. This guy was good. I like him. This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
Our first call together, a little grim souvenir collection there in the Hurt Locker. With us this hour, Command Sergeant Major Todd Burnett. He is active duty, one of the top IED specialists in the U.S. military today. Colonel Kevin Lutz, retired, is with us. He was at the top of the Army structure trying to root out, find, and deal with IEDs in Iraq, also in Afghanistan. Three tours, two Bronze Hearts, now with AT Solutions, and retired Captain Jonathan Hunter worked with Colonel Lutz and did a lot of work in Afghanistan, Coast, Kandahar. He is now at Allen Vanguard. They make the suits that were featured in the Hurt Locker. Joe in Stowe, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
So I just had a quick question. I've had the opportunity to work with quite a few EOD people.
Again, this is the explosive ordnance device groups, those who disarm, defuse, dismantle.
Yes, but in low-stress situations. But they've all been the most mellow, calm people you could ever imagine meeting. And I've often wondered if that was a self-selecting trait or if there's some selection process that chooses for that.
We'll ask. Captain Hunter, do you select soldiers to work in this arena that are especially calm and mellow, to use our caller's words?
Well, I will just say, like Colonel Lutz said, this is a completely volunteer field, MOS. So basically what that means is you can't not get selected unless you want to be EOD. And then you have to go through a 39 to 46-week training course down in Florida, depending on what service you're working in, and you have to get through that. And it's more academic than it is physical, and that kind of weeds out the mental stresses that you would encounter in the EOD application as well.
Academic meaning what? What do you mean exactly by that?
The standard passing grade in the military is 70%. So if you're an artilleryman or an infantryman, 70% is passing. In EOD, it's right around 90%.
Now, that's because when you're down there in the dirt and the dust and you're looking at this explosive device and its wiring, you've got to be pretty sharp to figure out what you're faced with.
Well, I like to say you got to put on your A game.
Mm-hmm.
And 90% is A or better, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that tends to weed out. I think right now we're about 50% success rate of people going through EOD school. First time.
Well, people go. Alex, Worcester, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Alex.
Yeah, hello, Tom. I had a question. When I was in Iraq, I knew there was some tension between engineers and EOD, specifically EOD saying things like we had to clean up after engineers. What I'm wondering about now is...
Hey, Alex, can you explain that before your question? Meaning engineers who, what, might have been driving bulldozers through or something? Or
No. When we're talking about military engineers, we're talking about, especially at the battalion level, at the level I was at, we're talking about infantrymen, well, elements of infantrymen who know how to use breaching devices, explosives, who are kind of like sappers.
And where does the cleanup, what would create a cleanup necessity here?
What was happening very early in the war, very quickly, were, you know, the infantry battalions and the armor battalions were going through, and they were finding large quantities of explosives. There were too few EOD people, so they couldn't call in EOD to come in and clean up these massive quantities of explosives. So they would say instead, okay, I have engineers, let my engineers go and handle it, you know, either by, you know, trying to demolish them themselves or by placing them where they were supposed to be. And I guess what I'm wondering now is, has there been more intertraining between EOD and the engineers? And has there become somewhat of a working relationship so that they can help each other out? Also, if they could discuss naval EOD, because I know they're a lot different in certain ways than Army EOD. That's kind of just a specific thing I was interested in.
Well, look at that. Thank you. Command Sergeant Major, what do you say, a collaboration between engineers and EOD or tension, as our caller was saying there?
There's a collaboration. There was some things
that went on in the beginning, but of course it got to a point where there was more IEDs and a longer wait time than was necessary. So we came up with two courses to help identify engineers that could get trained that could, within the guidelines of some policy that was set and it didn't overstep their bounds, could do some disposing of IEDs. Now, again, there was some pretty stiff rules put on it and the policy put on it, and it was all vetted through the explosive ordnance device community. And this came at a point where we had more IEDs, again, than we had EOD, but it was still many things put in. So I think we've come a long ways, and I think it was more of a collaboration, to be quite honest with you, than tension, and it just came... it came at a good point, and sometimes we relook the policy now. It's not always needed in every area and whatnot, but there was a lot of things that had to be in place before the engineers could blow that IED.
Colonel Lutz, you've said it's a kind of a loss of opportunity if the IED is just blown. You want to go in and dismantle it to more or less see the fingerprints, to start to learn what you're up against in the bomb makers, I guess.
Absolutely, and then you know, there's two scenarios. If you've got to breach the IED because of the mission requirement time,
breach as in just blow it up,
and, mm-hmm. and move forward to, mm-hmm. to the objective. I mean, that's more of a conventional warfare. You've got to do that. That's what you do. And then, but if you, what you want to do when you have the opportunity and when you can allow the force to take the time is you want to learn as much about the IED as possible, because it does allow us to take that IED back and test it against personnel and equipment to facilitate whether or not we need to make modifications or we need to acquire. I would tell you, from this whole process, all the equipment that we have today in theater in large part came from that. Also, then it helps us to identify those involved, and I won't go into those details. I mean, there is some healthy competition between the engineers and the EOD, and as Command Sergeant Major Burnett said, I mean, we've really moved beyond. Back in 2004, there was relatively a few number of EOD teams. At the height when I had Task Force Troy, I had over 1,200 Joint Service EOD forces. I didn't have the Marines, but I had all the Army, Air Force, and Navy. So we've come a long ways, and the wait times are not as long. And then we've integrated the warfighter to take some ownership, too, so that he can provide the security to the forces. I will also
by wait time, you mean to get your specialty team out there on the scene doing their work?
Right. I mean, it wasn't just the EOD forces. It takes time. Once an IED is found by the force, then you've got to get that reported back into the EOD forces, and that's not always easy. I mean, it comes back into a command post and maybe at a brigade level, and then it comes into a division. But whoever owns the battle space, and then you've got to notify the EOD, and then you've got to have security waiting and go with those. We've evolved now that most time security is already dedicated to EOD. In the previous time during 2004, it wasn't. It was almost like a pickup game. Okay, you got an IED event, so let's get some security and go out. And so mm-hmm. that could take 3 or 4 hours.
And what about naval explosive, naval EOD work?
Well, they're actually the same. We go through the same school. The difference there is Navy handles everything that's below tide. They have the underwater capability. They also jump. We are moving toward that. The Army is learning, going through school.
So where would underwater explosives show up in these wars?
Well, I mean, in all your ports. They clear the ports.
Has that been a big issue? We haven't heard, at least I haven't, much about mines in ports.
In initial, when they went into the ports there in Kuwait and southern Iraq, they had to clear those.
Mm-hmm.
We would use Navy EOD when we would lose helicopters and planes in the water, but they transition into a war or a ground effort. And again, we go through the same school. They have some mobility skills that the Army and the Air Force and Marines don't. I will tell you, the Army is moving toward providing similar mobility skills, particularly air assault, where you repel out of a helicopter, and then airborne, where you parachute out of a plane into a threat area. We won't pick up I don't see the Army picking up the diving capability that mm-hmm. the Navy has.
Let's go to Alex in New Haven, Connecticut. Alex, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to sort of share my story. My uncle's in civil affairs, and he's been bouncing between Afghanistan and Iraq for pretty much the past decade, almost decade. And last year, he was injured by an IED. A bomb had gone off, and he had to go out with the cadaver dogs to find recover bodies of civilians. And he'd parked his car, and it's out of character for him not to follow protocol, so I don't know exactly what happened. But 2 minutes after he got out of the car, another bomb went off, and it exploded. It sent him flying across the street, thrown like a rag doll. He had whiplash and just a pretty deep gash in his leg, so he was very, very lucky to have been spared what could have happened. But I don't think people ever really appreciate what you guys do as far as how much it saves civilian lives. I get people who are, you know, pretty cold and nasty to say, oh, well, these people don't want you in your in their country. That's why they're doing this. That bomb went off near civilians. It was meant to kill civilians. My uncle was going to find the bodies of civilians to give them back to their families.
Mm-hmm.
And what you guys are doing, I don't think anybody really appreciates the gift that you're giving to just normal, everyday people that are just trying to live in a country where these terrible things happen.
Who find themselves in these war zones. It's a good point, Captain Hunter. You must have seen that again and again. These are in population centers. It's not just soldiers of any uniform walking around here.
Absolutely. Every experience is personal. And, you know, EOD, most military, there's a greater sense of greater good. So it's not about the individual. It's not even about the country. It's about my effort in Afghanistan is serving the world in a better place. And one example would be an Afghan village that had Taliban placed a ton of ordnance in a well, and they couldn't use the well anymore because it was polluted with ordnance. And we went in, we did what we did, cleaned it up, and he just came up to me and gave me the biggest hug, and he started crying because that was his life, his water source.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't know that. They don't hear these stories. And it truly affects me the rest of my life.
They got their water back.
Yeah.
Let's go to Santa Cruz, California. Bob, you're on the air, Bob.
Yes, hi, Tom. If we could go back to the movie for just a second.
Sure.
The very first thing in the movie, they mention war is addictive.
Mm-hmm.
The most important scene in the movie, in my opinion, he's alone with his baby child, tells him how wonderful it is to be at that age and love everything, but eventually some things happen in a person's life. They come to love only one thing anymore. The last scene in the movie, he's walking back down to disarm a bomb. The message of the movie, war is addictive. It's adrenaline. Adrenaline is addictive. The same thing happens to criminals who are in prison and come out and go back in. It's so boring, they can't stand it. They're not in a life and death situation anymore. Believe me, adrenaline is addictive. Even the greatest philosophers have mentioned how war artificially, temporarily wakes men up.
Bob, let us look at it, Colonel Lutz. It may be so. Of course, it's only so if you come home. You lost, as I understand it, over 20 people doing this work under your command. But for those who come home, you raised PTSD yourself, and you hear Bob speaking again there to the addictive power of the tension, the adrenaline. What do you say?
He brings up a valid point. It's how each individual handles it. And that's, I mean, there's nothing out there scientific that says this individual is going to handle it better than this individual. I think we all have gone through that. I mean, I'm probably still going through it after my last 15-month deployment and just retiring 30 days ago from the Army.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes an empty feeling. And then you've got, and then, but I would tell you that the military has gone a long ways in setting the conditions and preparing you for your transition. You go through a very detailed process in theater. To identify things that you've seen, you've been exposed to, reintegration, so that you can deal with it better than just sending you back to your family. And that's what happened in 2004. So what mm-hmm. happened to him was not uncommon. Is they'd come back out of the fight with the adrenaline high, and then they were left there, and they didn't have the ability to do what they were good at, and they were having mm-hmm. success. And it was a challenge for many, and it still is today. But the military has stepped up to try to reduce that, and it's each individual handles it differently.
What about, do you ever, do you still worry, ponder the... I mean, people talk about the futility of war, but I would think in this kind of work, that might really be highlighted. It's so relatively easy to bury a bomb and walk away. How do you ever end it, stop it, get past it, Colonel?
Well, I think if you look at it's identifying those who are involved, and we've got to be more proactive versus reactive, and that's where we've come over the years, and that's missed or not acknowledged. A lot of that's due to the classifications and security and not letting the enemy know what we're doing, but you've got it to identify those folks that are involved with it, but you also have to win the populace. That's the whole part of the counterinsurgency strategy is winning the hearts and minds of the people, so that you know they turn those folks in and they actually aid you in doing this. So there's not one solution set to it. You've got to work through the whole mindset of working with the populace and then also protecting yourself and dealing with the IEDs as you are confronted with those.
Big, hard, deadly challenge with a long tail. Colonel Kevin Lutz, 2 Bronze Stars, service in Task Force Troy in Iraq, service in Afghanistan, now with AT Solutions. Thank you for joining us today, Colonel.
You're welcome. Thank you, Tom.
Captain Jonathan Hunter with Allen Vanguard, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And Command Sergeant Major Todd Burnett, thank you very much for being with us, Sergeant Major.
Thank you. And I'd just like to close by telling the one thing that people need to remember is when a bomb goes off, we need to blame somebody, and that's the Taliban.
We hear it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.